This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For over 3 weeks, protesters in Portland, part of a nationwide movement against racial injustice, have been terrorized.
Video emerged on Twitter apparently showing federal officers dressed in camouflage grabbing protesters off the streets of Portland.
Without name tags and without any indication of what agency they work for.
Sometimes for up to a week, they're holding them.
These federal forces deployed by the White House have prompted a lawsuit from the Oregon Attorney General against the agencies that command them for unprecedented overreach. And late Thursday, a federal judge issued a restraining order barring those forces from arresting or using physical force against journalists and stated that the press could ignore those officers' orders to disperse. President Trump says he did it to block efforts to, quote, wipe out our history. Here and there, America's memorialized men have taken a few knocks.
This weekend in Baltimore, on the 4th of July, protesters ripped down a Christopher Columbus statue, throwing it into the city's harbor.
The statue of Jefferson Davis was pulled down in Richmond.
If you care about racial justice, those guys had it coming. But
statue of abolitionist legend Frederick Douglass torn down over the weekend in Rochester, New York.
In Portland, protesters have pulled down the Jefferson statue in front of Jefferson High School, toppled George Washington on the lawn of the German American Society, and set fire to a bronze elk dedicated to a former mayor. Turns out, though, that arguing over and tearing down monuments is very much part of our history. Kirk Savage, a professor of the history of art and architecture at the University of Pittsburgh, has written about the history of U.S. monuments all his career. He says that discord can be traced back to a time when there was only one major statue in all the land, that of King George III, erected in 1770 on New York City's Bowling Green. And on July 9th, 1776, American revolutionaries destroyed it with extreme prejudice.
They took King George's head and sliced his nose off and melted down much of the statue and turned it into bullets that would go back into the bodies of the British soldiers.
After George Washington died, there were calls for monuments. And there was a debate over whether a nation founded on principles of democracy and equality should have them at all.
You know, the whole idea of a monument was to erect something that actually represented the authority of that government as kind of God-given and lasting forever. And that is antithetical to the project of a democratic republic in which people are governed by citizens governing themselves. That argument was made in the wake of Washington's death, that all monuments in some form or another were representations of tyranny.
You quote North Carolina Congressman Nathaniel Macon, who said the year after Washington died, "Monuments are good for nothing. The money could be better spent teaching the poor how to read so they could learn Washington's story for themselves."
You know, it's a great argument, and in 1800 was being passionately debated in Congress and in the press. John Nicholas made perhaps the most amazing anti-monumental proposal. He proposed that over Washington's tomb should be erected what he called a plain tablet on which men could write what their heart dictated. The whole idea was this would be a living memorial, right? And it would only last as long as those citizens felt strongly enough to write in this blank tablet.
So we're having this debate, and the statues are built anyway.
In the first 30, 40 years of the 19th century, there were several campaigns to erect statues of Washington in cities around the country. And this culminated in a U.S. congressional commission for a statue of Washington for the rotunda of the Capitol building. This statue of Washington was notorious for a lot of reasons, but he is colossal, seated at a throne in a posture that was based on the ancient Greek statue of Zeus at Olympia. He is bare-chested with bulging pecs and the whole business, right? Mm-hmm. So he's represented as a kind of all-powerful god. It certainly was not Citizen George Washington, that's for sure.
Can we hop ahead to the Civil War? It was a time of self-examination for the nation.
We have to remember that at this point in time, there were still relatively few public monuments in the United States. But the assassination of Lincoln and the Union victory generated lots and lots of calls for monuments in 1865-66. At the same time, there were many people calling for the creation of what they called utilitarian memorials, which would be things like schools and hospitals, veterans' homes, naming them after Union war heroes.
But the anti-utilitarians, like the critic Walter Dean Howells, who you quote, wrote in 1866 that there should be representative art.
Howells had spent the war years in Italy as a diplomat. He was so impressed with how much beautiful art there was in Italy and how it was woven into daily life. He came back to the United States thinking that what the U.S. needed was monuments that in some way expressed the incredible change that the war had wrought on the country, what he called the change in races, ethics, and ideas. And so the one piece that he could point to was this little statuette of a Black man, obviously at rest, paused on his flight to freedom.
The picture of the freedman shows someone who is focused, who's full of dignity, and who is utterly self-possessed.
Absolutely. It was first exhibited in New York in 1863. It was a very controversial selection, and it was put into a dimly lit corner. So that gives you an idea of how a dignified representation of a Black man trying to escape to freedom was in itself incredibly controversial.
The dominant issue in the North was a vision of Lincoln as a hero slash liberator.
Uplifting the Black race to citizenship and freedom.
It's kind of appalling, the Emancipation Memorial that was erected in D.C.
The Emancipation Memorial was actually the very first monument in the United States that represented a Black figure. And it reverted to this old formula of the white savior and the kneeling Black slave. It was funded entirely by the contributions of Black people, mostly Black Union soldiers, but they had absolutely no input into the design. And the artist was chosen by a white philanthropic organization. So there's no hint in that monument of the incredibly important and active role that enslaved people took in their own liberation.
The enslaved themselves are bit players.
Yes. Now, the Emancipation Proclamation that Lincoln is holding in that monument, he issued because enslaved people had already been taking their own destiny into their hands and escaping and reaching the Union lines. And he'd gotten to a point where he realized he probably could only win the war by enlisting these people into the Union Army. None of that, of course, appears in any way in the statue. What the monument did was to freeze that really unfortunate moment for all time. The Black man in the monument is forever kneeling at Lincoln's feet. He's never going to rise in that monument. And that image became very iconic. It was reproduced at the end of Thomas Edison's film of Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1902. It was put on a postage stamp in the 20th century to commemorate the 13th Amendment, the abolition of slavery. It normalized white supremacy in the monumental landscape and made it, I think, much more possible for the Lost Cause commemoration to flourish.
I'm just wondering, given your long immersion in this mixed history of monuments, how do you feel about what we're seeing right now?
It's really a stunning outcome for me personally, because throughout the 1990s, a lot of these Confederate monuments, there was absolutely no talk of removing them whatsoever. And in fact, many of them were being restored, and some of them were even being rededicated. The neo-Confederate movement was in full swing. The last thing I would have ever dreamed at that moment was that any of these monuments would come down.
How do you feel about it?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I do actually support the removal of most Confederate monuments. I made the argument back in 1997 that these were white supremacist monuments, and I feel like, well, that argument has won.
But you're also a historian. These are artifacts.
Yes. So, you know, as art historians, we're committed to preservation, but there are different ways to conserve monuments. They don't have to be up in public space in honorific positions. But at the same time, I think, you know, what's happening at the sites of these monuments right now is so incredible.
The Lee Confederate Monument, now a Virginia centerpiece for the Black Lives Matter movement.
It says freedom. It says, like, liberation. People coming together for one cause.
The whole question that monuments raise is really a question of engagement. How are we going to activate these sites and use them in a way to advance the project of democracy and to advance the project of equality, to advance the project of Black Lives Matter? How are we going to do that? That's really the question for me. It's the problem of democratic engagement. I don't think that we need permanent monuments, and that we would be better off if we continually renewed the memorial landscape. You know, I made a proposal at the end of my book on the memorial landscape of Washington, D.C., that we should have a moratorium on all permanent monument building for 10 years and just have temporary projects to see what might happen. Not abandoning entirely the idea of permanent monuments, but maybe abandoning it for the next century.
We want public squares.
Right. This has been done in other places. There's the fourth plinth in London, an empty plinth that was supposed to have a statue in it that was never made in the last decade or so. Artists come in and they erect these temporary monuments on the plinth 6 months at a time. It would really engage the public in ways that could be a lot more powerful than erecting a statue to somebody that nobody has heard of anymore and really didn't even care about in the first place.
Kirk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kirk Savage is a professor of the history of art and architecture at the University of Pittsburgh.
Coming up, how the pandemic will change our built world.
This is On the Media.